Thank you, Carolyn. Next, we will hear from Patricia Tilburg. Trish received her PhD from UCLA and is professor of history at Davidson College, where she is also currently chair of gender and sexuality studies program there. It's that age in life, isn't it? She is the author of articles in French Historical Studies and Radical History Review, among others, and of the monograph Colette's Republic, Work, Gender, and Popular Culture in France, 1870 to 1914, published by Burgon in 2009. She is currently working on a cultural history of the women of the Parisian garment trade in the late 19th and 20th centuries, which is the basis of this paper today. The paper is entitled La Femme au Corsage Rouge, Monette Thomas, Midinette Militancy, and the Garment Strikes of 1918 to 1919.
I can't add very much to the wonderful remarks by Andrea and Carolyn about Eleanor. I third everything that they said, but I did want to just thank Eleanor for years and years now of really engaged feminist mentorship. It's been really valuable to me, and for modeling work that excavates the lives and work of French women from the fin de siècle through the interwar in a way that was critical, skeptical, expansive in its historical understanding, and to me, most importantly, always, always deeply humane. And that's been really important to my work. So thank you, Eleanor. So from 1901, the Parisian clothing trade saw a remarkable escalation of labor activism and subsequent legislative reform driven by and on behalf of the more than 80,000 women working in the capital's couture industry. Time and again, in 1901, 1908, 1910, 1911, 1916, 17, 18, 19, 23, 35, and 36, the midinettes of Paris took to the boulevards in work stoppages, which garnered meaningful gains for garment workers across the city and, in some cases, across the country. And yet, throughout these strikes, French journalists, government officials, and labor leaders alike promoted a romantic and infantilizing vision of the female garment strikers as insouciant girls in need of paternal care, whether of the state or the syndicat. Yes, indeed. I don't know what that is. I'll just go on. I like to have a soundtrack. Okay. This is going to be very emotional. So the pervasive Belle Epoque type of the midinette as sexually available, carefree, and politically docile is everywhere in popular culture in this period. And actually, the book that I'm working on traces this material, traces the image of the midinette through pop culture, through novels and songs and poems. These are not images that are really difficult to find. They are everywhere, kind of hiding in plain sight, I would say. So what became clear to me as I was working on this project over time is that I wanted to constantly looking for the women themselves, some sense of their own experience of their lives as workers, as women. But the available sources for this were quite meager, as it turned out. And particularly around the strikes, these strikes that happened over the course of between 1901 and through the interwar, nonetheless, this image just persisted and persisted of the midinette as sexually available, as politically naive. I wanted to see what the women themselves might have felt and thought about the grève, the strikes. So the midinette took her name from the noon lunch hour when couture workers were observed fanning out across the Parisian center and were featured in pop culture and entertainment as this inescapable urban type, the young female seamstress, the flower maker, the hat maker, with inimitable Parisian taste, a ready smile, and a good heart. The midinette was in many ways an updated version of the grisette, the romantic era grisette, and she carried with her the grisette's romantic guilelessness and was principally an object of bourgeois male pleasure in these images. She was also identified with the production of finely made couture goods and with post-Haussmann urban spectacle, physically attractive, frivolous, cheerful, and inseparable from bourgeois desire. Now, strike observers conflated this image, the fictional MIDI-net, with actual garment trade militants. Across the political spectrum, journalists, labor leaders, and commentators remarked upon the attractiveness, the youth, and the charm of the MIDI-net enclave, and emphasized the lightheartedness of their protest. The MIDI-net...
Perfect!
It's perfect! That's good. Yeah. It's all good. So even labor activist commentary during the strikes were of a piece with the pop culture images of the MIDI-net. So I've brought these two examples, and there are lots and lots of them around the strikes. First, this one from the first set of seamstress strikes in 1901 shows this very frustrated male labor organizer trying to get a vote here in the Bourse du Travail in this strike of seamstresses, and the seamstresses, instead of raising their hands, are raising their legs, which serves at once to show them as politically idiotic and also sexualized, right? They're showing off their legs. Then in the other one, Après la bataille shows a MIDI-net, the strike is over, and she's walking away from her male partisan, these pipe fitters, these workers, and instead going off with a bourgeois man for a sexual dalliance. And so these are the images again and again of striking MIDI-net, that they politically know nothing and have no kind of sense when it comes to activism, and that they are merely sexual playthings for bourgeois men. So militant garment workers developed strike tactics, I'd argue, that capitalized on this MIDI-net type, or at least responded to it. In one strike in September 1910, for example, striking MIDI-net intent on entering a scab workshop evaded their police escort by playing off of their reputation as pleasure-seeking and unserious. When hemmed in by police near the city limits, several newspapers described the working women as capriciously abandoning the protest to picnic. As reported by La Petite République, when the women were blocked by police, they decided instead to purchase French fries and mussels and, quote, picnic gaily on the faded grass of the embankment. L'Humanité, however, revealed that this lighthearted picnic was in fact an evasive tactic. Protesters had left the Bourse du Travail in the morning, intent on entering this scab workshop on the Rue de Beigneur, but were pursued closely by police agents all morning. Therefore, the MIDI-nets, according to Humanité, quote, headed out of Paris and organized in small, smiling groups, light tea parties on the grass of the city wall. The police agents were bemused, quote, was this a country party or a manifestation? The police did not know what to think, really. Thus, they decided to abandon a surveillance that seemed as ridiculous as it was useless. L'Humanité revealed that this tactical maneuver worked, as the MIDI-net were then able to make their way unhindered to the shop on the Rue de Beigneur, where they attempted to debaucher workers who had not joined the strike. It's difficult, I think, to imagine a group of pipe fitters successfully evading police surveillance because the police decide that it was ridiculous or useless to follow them. In Parisian union halls, as on the boulevard, militant MIDI-net played a crucial role in the strikes of these years. While they were outnumbered at the lectern during most meetings by male union leaders, a number of MIDI-net turned labor activists addressed the hundreds and sometimes thousands of female garment workers that attended these meetings. One of these was Monet Thomas, labor leader and former garment worker, a militant MIDI-net whose speeches were well documented by police spies and by the socialist press, and who herself contributed frequently to the socialist newspaper Le Populaire. Thomas was a married seamstress who gave birth to a child during these years, a girl she and her husband named Louise Michel, hyphenated as her first name. Thomas was a key orator during garment strikes in 1918 and 19, held meetings of leftist groups such as the Ligue des Droits de l'Homme and the Comité d'Action Suffragiste at her home in Paris, and proudly joined what she called the MIDI-net movement. Thomas was held up by some on the left as an attractive exemplar of the MIDI-net militant. The socialist newspaper Le Populaire described her speeches at the Bourse du Travail and the Maison du Syndicat on the Rue Grand-Jobel in September 1918. Monet Thomas, with that penetrating knowledge of the psychology of the Parisian MIDI-net, they wrote, gave an extremely picturesque speech, sprinkled with anecdotes that were really very well received. The radical Republican daily Le Rebel took particular relish in personalizing and even eroticizing Thomas' numerous public appearances. When she joined the memorial march to the Mur des Fédérés honoring the Commune in 1919, the first of this traditional fête since the war, Le Rebel used her as an example of the obligatory femme au corsage rouge, as they put it, at such events. There is never, they wrote, a demonstration at Père Lachaise without a citoyen in a scarlet blouse. Madame Monet Thomas, wearing the red flag of the third arrondissement really stood out. We admired the mouth of Madame Thomas singing L'Internationale. So, needless to say, this was the only body part admired by the author in a piece that included references to numerous male partisans in attendance. So I should explain this image. I have no idea if this is a picture of Monet Thomas. There are lots of images of this event on May 26, 1919. Very few women are pictured. None are labeled in these images. But I thought that this image with the sort of half face of a woman behind the front row of men could be Monet Thomas. I don't really know. I can't find pictures of her yet. So I think that that's important. In more than one instance, Thomas was invoked as a feminine corrective to bourgeois propaganda about midinette immorality. In October 1918, Thomas castigated novelist and pop culture journalist Max Viterbo for suggesting that the midinette were using the strikes as a vacation. And this was a very common trope of the strikes, that the midinette didn't care about the strike, they just didn't want to go to work. Quote, he had joked rather crudely about the so-called holidays of Mimi Pinson, and by that he meant the seamstress's strike, end quote. Thomas was saluted by her comrades at Le Populaire for refuting Viterbo's characterization. Bravo, Monet Thomas. Monet Thomas, charming apostle, has just wrapped the fingers of Monsieur Max Viterbo. Viterbo was obliged to apologize. The editors at Le Populaire acknowledged that his remark was part of a broader dismissal of the midinette strike by some culture makers, but they imagined Thomas' rebuttal as in keeping with what they said was a generally sympathetic response. Quote, the public will not allow this nonsense of the very amusing strike of the frolicking midinette. Worker and socialist leader Maurice Morin found Thomas' speech at the Maison des Syndicats on September 25, 1918, a perfect and captivating example of the militant garment worker. Quote, Monet Thomas maintains more than ever the heart and the attention of her audience. She gives us a course in the extremely picturesque, always courageous, and sometimes powerfully inspiring morality of the working woman. It is truly effective to have Monet Thomas train students for action. Only a completely liberated woman can tell other women the things Thomas told them yesterday. Beyond her popularity with militants as representative of the esprit de midinette, Thomas herself spoke to and as one of the thousands of midinettes who came to listen to her speeches in these years. In 1918, for instance, Thomas expressed frustration that, quote, employers represent the midinette as a coquette, a woman who is not serious, who relies on the generosity of her lovers, despite the fact that we are honest women who have hearts and minds and needs to satisfy just as much as the daughters of the bourgeoisie. After the war, as the eight-hour workday was being discussed and becoming law, Thomas explained that this legislation would oblige female workers either to give up the hard-won semaine anglaise. She specifies this that the English week had been obtained by the working women of Couture, or to work long hours, still burdened by the, quote, double job of household tasks. Such a choice meant, Thomas wrote, the midinette cannot be satisfied. She went on to enumerate many tasks that occupied working women in their non-work hours and wrote movingly of women's need for true leisure hours in which they could, quote, dispose of their time in a useful or agreeable fashion. In this way, mamas could have the joy of taking their babes in arms for a walk. Wives could spend a little more time at home. Younger women, still exempt from worries, would be able to take advantage of this time as well. They would have the possibility, by educating themselves, of liberating their minds of the prejudices of current society. That sounds fun. Thomas recognizes that working women might use their hard-won leisure in diverse ways, both in socially beneficial roles as more attentive mothers and helpmeets, and in individually rewarding pastimes. Thomas describes here, then, a world of working women with complex and distinct needs and desires, united by a successful campaign for the Semaine Anglaise. Thomas and her socialist comrades at Le Populaire often employed the term midinette as a useful identity for female militants, rather than as a marker of political docility or naivete. Le Populaire described Thomas' speech at a union meeting in September 1918, in which she deftly explained the principal demands of the movement, the eight-hour day and a cost-of-living allowance. They said that these demands were animated by Thomas' esprit de midinette, Her speech emphasized the compatibility of an esprit de midinette with lucid political argumentation. When Thomas herself took issue with the labor ministry's statement during these same strikes that the cost of living allowance of 3 francs should not raise a worker's salary above 15 francs, she did so in the voice of a midinette, using the image of a politically engaged midinette to challenge the ministry. Quote, should the midinettes be restricted in this way to a mediocre wage while their exploiters alone have the right to lucrative profits? The Cousette aim to prevail in winning the right to a material existence with the cost of living allowance and the right to an intellectual existence with the 8-hour day. End quote. As a former seamstress and as a labor militant, Thomas herself identified with the term midinette, though she associated always with clear political purpose and organization, not empty-headed frivolity. Thomas played an unusual role, I argue, in the strike meetings of 1918 and 19 by managing the public image of the midinette from inside that culture. She interacted with and advised the midinettes on their militancy as one of their own. In the fall of 1918, she met with strike delegates before union meetings to collect their individual assessments of movements in their shops. On the afternoon of September 23, 1918, Thomas encouraged the 2,000 female couture strikers at the Maison des Syndicats to maintain a calm demeanor and proper conduct, as she put it, on the street, quote, as to not indispose public opinion and to not provoke incidents by forcing the police to intervene, end quote. She also suggested the midinette, quote, not sing any songs with a patriotic or anti-patriotic leaning to avoid giving the movement a political character. Previous strikes often saw the midinette singing the Internationale. Thomas instead recommended that strikers learn a new song that would appear in Le Populaire the following day, written by a midinette expressly for these strikes. Quote, a song concerned uniquely with the seamstresses' movement and underscoring their demands. The next day at the Maison des Syndicats, Thomas again gave the striking midinettes this advice to have proper conduct on the street, that she said malevolent eyes are trained upon them and that good conduct in the street was indispensable. She again announced that there would be this song that was going to appear in the Populaire, created especially, she said, for the working women of the clothing industry, which will be the rallying chant of the working women on strike. Garment militants took Thomas' advice about the choice of song, as a police report from the 25th of September noted the strikers, quote, let us hear at several moments rather inoffensive songs, such as that published in Le Populaire, especially for the midinette. 2 days later, at a meeting of some 3,000 militants at the Salle de la CGT, the working women sang, quote, their strike song, titled La Grange aux Belles. This song that appeared on the 25th of September in Le Populaire was described as, quote, an unpretentious song by a midinette written for the strike of 1918 and meant to be sung to the tune of Auprès de ma blonde, a jaunty kind of romantic tune dating back to the 17th century. The new lyrics melded attractive and nostalgic signs of the traditional midinette with confident activism. In the early verses, the midinette sing of their scenic arrival at the Union Hall, a pretty gaggle of Mimi Pinson. Their auditors are assured that the midinette are loyal working women and that their female clients will be satisfied. But this satisfaction is dependent upon the garment workers' economic viability. The lyrics, the client satisfied my purse too. The last verses become more insistent in their economic demands. Quote, to hell with your promises, we need something in writing. 3 francs, 3 francs cost of living and 8 hours too, rest for mothers, bread for the kids. The seamstresses march under the sign of a pretty 19th century literary heroine and assert their devotion to labor and even to customer satisfaction, but they also assert precise economic demands with a healthy skepticism for patronal duplicity. By coordinating action and behavior during the strikes, Thomas and other union leaders exhibited a keen understanding of the public representation of the striking midinette. They decried the image of the midinette strike in the bourgeois press and carefully planned the aesthetic presentation of the marches themselves. Garment workers like Thomas were well aware of the power of derogatory elements of the midinette type. In her speech at the Maison des Syndicats on the 23rd of September, Thomas stoked the indignation of assembled working women by recounting the words of a garment trade patron from the Rue d'Antin, who had told her female workers, quote, yes, if we grant you the 8-hour day, you'll have more time to go shut yourselves up in those houses where the blinds are always closed. The audience reacted with astonishment and indignation. Couturier Jean Paquin was pilloried throughout these proceedings as an example of a midinette who had betrayed her sisters and who had not risen to power by, quote, honest means. flourishes of this sort affirmed the Medinet's collective identity as industrious and respectable, in stark contrast to the image of Paquin, a Medinet manqué. Police spies noted that this speech played nicely off of Paquin's, quote, marked unpopularity in the world of seamstresses. So now I'm going to look briefly at the events of the fall 1918 strike, in which Thomas was a key player, and it shows the way that these clashes periodically could happen between female militants like Thomas and the male labor leadership. In the first weeks of October 1918, as the garment strike neared an end, it was the Medinet who pushed to continue the work stoppage, while several male union leaders counseled the couture workers to end the strike and accept the compromises offered by the patron. Marchoux and Jouot of the CGT took to the podium at the Grand Jobel on the 4th of October to convince Medinets they had already gained enough appreciable results. But they were shouted down continually by Medinet cries of, quote, what about the eight-hour day? Continue the strike by the assembled garment workers. Jouot became perceptibly frustrated and warned the assembled working women, quote, don't come running crying to your militant brothers in a couple of days if by an impulsive move you decide to continue this strike today. Jouot's warning was typical of male union responses to Medinet, framing them as impulsive and emotional. Thomas then rose to say that while the gains of the strike were indeed not negligible, they should be wary of ending it before anything was signed on paper with their employers, reframing Medinet caprice as sage political caution. Lefebvre, a metalsmith and secretary of the Union des Syndicats de la Seine and the so-called darling of the Medinet, reproached male militants for playing the role of either makers or breakers of the strike, as he put it, and assured female strikers, quote, you alone are mistresses of the situation. Monet Thomas rose again the next day to argue the strike should not end before the resolution of the eight-hour day question. Her argument, unlike those of male orators, spoke to the realities of Medinet labor. She suggested the Medinet that should the Medinet return to work without a signed agreement on the eight-hour day, their employers would surely insist about 10-hour days for a time in order to make up for all the orders that had backed up during the time they had been on strike. Following Thomas, several female delegates from various shops urged the continuation of the strike. The final vote was 957 to 715 on that day in favor of continuing the strike. 5 days later, as the strike dragged on, Millerat, while publicly supportive of the Medinet, privately expressed frustration with their unwillingness to return to work. According to a police spy, quote, poor Millerat is in despair. He said, I don't know what they've got in their heads or what they want to happen. If tomorrow we bring them the eight-hour day, they'll ask for something else. I don't know who is pushing them, but surely someone is working from behind the scenes. He suspected male union members were, quote, agitating the working women. The female strikers' resistance, then, is incomprehensible to Millerat without some male agency at its root. By the 12th of October, the couture workers finally signed an agreement to end the strike without a clear concession on the eight-hour day. But by way of conclusion, I would argue the deliberations of that week in October open a window into the particular activism of the Medinet en grève. First, some male syndical leaders conceived of Medinet activism as feminine caprice and recklessness when not in harmony with their objectives. Second, the strike meetings in October 1918 bear witness to the autonomous, if fractured, political voice of the Medinet during this strike. Undoubtedly, garment workers were not unanimous in their approach to the strike. They spoke often discordantly to each other and to the syndical leadership about their demands, and bristled at the imposition of political direction from militants they deemed disloyal to their goals. But they also appear, by 1918, to have been well-versed in Parisian strike culture, and clear as a group both about the stakes of labor militancy and about their considerable role in Parisian labor politics. Thank you.